Alia Swaya says she was simply experimenting. The 9-year-old girl lives in a small town in North Carolina. Her father's Muslim, so when his friends come over, many of the women wear the headscarf. Alia's mother is not Muslim and more inclined to wear a T-shirt in warm weather. So Alia says trying the headscarf was one way of seeing where she fit in.
Like, I'd wear it for 3 days in a row. I'd wear it for a day. And then a month later, I'd wear it for 2 days. I kind of wanted to see how it felt for one day or a few days in a row, just to see what it's like.
Alia's mother, Krista, says she was surprised at her own reaction. At first, she didn't want her daughter to go out in public wearing the headscarf. She was afraid people would stare. And some of them did. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced by American Public Media.
Coming up later in the program, some good news, finally, for a Mexican journalist who fled the violence in Juarez. First, though, to questions about the headscarf. For a delicate piece of cloth, it stirs controversy around the world. Today, in Kosovo and South India, girls are being told they can't wear a headscarf in public school. And it's a debate that's still underway in Spain and France and Russia and Turkey. Those opposed to the wearing of the headscarf regard it as a provocative religious symbol. Muslims say it's a simple demonstration of public modesty. This is a story about a 9-year-old American girl who decided she wanted to wear a headscarf. Alia Swaya's father is from Libya, and he's used to that in his family. Alia's mother is from California, and, well, all of this has been quite a challenge for her. Krista Bremer is a writer and works at a literary magazine. She wrote about her reservations concerning her daughter's headscarf, and the article got quite a response.
I have been inundated with emails from Muslims all over the world and also from non-Muslims, many of whom say I'm a shameful parent or criticize that choice. But the funny thing is that this was not, for me, about whether the headscarf is right or wrong, but it was about my relationship with my daughter, honoring her emergent individuality, and accepting how little control I ultimately have over her future, and also how little I know about her future.
It all started one day at a Muslim festival when Krista's daughter, Alia, picked up her first headscarf. It was at a stall where they were laid out for sale.
Everyone was everywhere. I mean, wherever you looked, you saw people. There was no certain place where not many people were.
Now, you're not that tall. Were you feeling a little hemmed in by all these people?
Yes. And there were a lot of tents, and people were selling Muslim clothing and hijabs and Indian clothing and incense and just stuff like that. And so my mom and I were, like, walking around, and we got henna, and we were just, and then we saw the stand, and we paused to look at them, and then...
These were just pieces of cloth folded up on a table, right? I mean, you couldn't really see them as scarves?
Well, they were in little transparent plastic bags, and they were two-piece headscarves.
Can you explain that to me? Two-piece. What are the two pieces, just so I'm clear in my mind?
The first piece is, it's a small cylinder, and it goes over your forehead, and then the second piece is long, and it goes over your shoulders, and you put it over the first piece.
And so when you're wearing both pieces, you're kind of covered, what, down to your waist or down to your elbows? How far down?
Down to probably halfway between shoulders and elbows.
Were they letting people try these on, or did you have to look at them through the plastic?
I think you could take them out, but I don't think we were trying them on.
What were you thinking?
Well, this was kind of the first time I'd seen them on sale, because there aren't many places that sell headscarves. And I kind of wanted one, and so I saw one that I liked, and I asked my mom for it, and she was hesitant. And
what do you mean hesitant?
Sometimes she hesitates before giving me an answer if I ask for something. And she just thought about it. And
you could tell she was thinking about it.
Yeah.
Right?
And she was... She seemed like she didn't really know what to say to me because she didn't know whether she wanted me wearing a headscarf or she didn't. And if she liked the idea of me wearing a headscarf or she didn't. And it was kind of, I think it was a moment of, like, a big decision for her because that would have been my first headscarf. And then she said yes. And we got a light green one with dark green sparkles all over it.
Sparkles that were woven into the fabric?
It was just, like, regular craft sparkles.
So some of them came off on you when you put it on?
Yeah, I get very sparkly when I put it on.
When Alia Sueya got home from the festival, she went to her bedroom and put on her new headscarf.
And I looked in the mirror, and I was surprised because I'd seen it on others, and I had my thoughts about it, and it just seemed different on me.
What was surprising for you?
Just, it's so different from the clothes we normally wear. I liked it. I thought it looked pretty beautiful, whether it was on me or not. And I just liked headscarves in general.
Now, part of what you would have been thinking, tell me if I'm wrong here, but uh-huh. I would think part of what you'd be thinking is, where do I want to wear this? Do I want to go outside the house with it? What will my dad say? What will my mom say?
Yeah. Part of me wanted to go kind of outside of the house because I like being different, and but I wasn't sure whether my parents would let me, and I really wanted to.
So how much time did you spend in your bedroom before you came out and showed your headscarf to your mother and father?
Looked at myself in the mirror for a while because it was so different, and yeah. I was kind of surprised, and I kind of examined it, and then I went and showed my parents, and they were impressed.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Alia's mother, Krista Bremer, and her husband, Ismail, had agreed when they got married that they would be open to one another's cultures and support that with their kids. But Krista had always felt uncomfortable about headscarves. And her daughter Alia was right. She did hesitate about buying that green, sparkly headscarf.
I assumed that the headscarf would end up at the back of the closet. I was on my way to our local grocery store, to the Harris Teeter, and she called out to me and said, "Mom, wait, I want to come with you."
I came down the stairs wearing jeans and a t-shirt and a headscarf, which was an interesting mix.
I was honestly... shocked at the way she looked because she resembles her father. I rarely hear that my daughter looks like me. You know, she has his darker coloring, his dark eyes, his dark hair. But when she put this headscarf on, it felt like this transformation was complete and she really looked like a foreigner to me in that moment.
I think she could tell based on just, like, my personality that I wanted to wear it because I was currently wearing it and while asking her if I could come.
She's your mother. She knows you, right?
Yeah.
I didn't want her to wear it to the grocery store.
Why?
Because I just wanted to pick up some milk and grab a loaf of bread.
This was supposed to be a simple trip to the grocery store,
exactly.
Not a sort of epic voyage of emerging adulthood. Right?
That's exactly right. And so I drove with her to the store, and I kept looking at her in the rearview mirror. And
your husband wasn't with you, right?
No.
Okay.
And he seemed fairly nonchalant about it as well. He didn't, right. You know, he wasn't concerned. And I was thinking about whether I could ask her to remove it, but I couldn't think of a good reason why she should. And I also was struck by this hypocrisy that I felt in that moment, because I've always told my daughter that she should resist peer pressure and she should be an individual. And yet in this moment, I felt terribly self-conscious and I wanted to fit in among these strangers at the store whom I didn't even know.
And so we went and I got stared at.
What I remember is that we got out of the car, and in the car, I felt this irritation.
She's testing me, exactly. Or she's doing this to bother me or something.
Exactly. Yeah. But then when we got out of the car, almost immediately, I noticed people looking at us, which made sense because, you know, I'm this tall, blonde woman. I was wearing a tank top. It was the middle of the summer, and I had this short Muslim with me. And so in that moment, my feeling of irritation turned into a protective instinct toward her.
That's my daughter.
That's right. And I pulled her close to me. And so we walked into the store together. And I was really aware of the reactions that people had toward us and just the ways that people would sort of spin their head all the way around to watch us pass as, you know, we went down the aisle. Or
one person did say, something like, my, what a precious young lady.
Speaking to you or to your mother?
I think to both of us.
Okay.
But I didn't get asked questions, so.
You know, they would give us, some people gave us very gracious smiles that almost seemed cloying to me. It was a little bit too
patronizing.
Too patronizing, yeah. Exactly. So it was just, it was a memorable trip to the store.
Alia found the experience interesting enough that she then wore the headscarf to one of the Muslim gatherings her family attends to test the reaction there. Then she wore it to school. I'll talk more with Krista Bremer and her daughter, Alia Sweya, about what that was like in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Earlier this month, thousands of people took to the streets of Pristina in Kosovo to protest against a government ban on headscarves. As common as this head covering is in Muslim countries, it's often criticized by people who view it as a too visible exhibition of religion. Many in the West view it as a form of oppression. Well, for the past year, 9-year-old Alia Sweya has been experimenting with wearing a headscarf. She says she wears it depending on the weather and how she feels that day. And this has forced her mother, Krista Bremer, to face the fact that her daughter's growing up, but also to face her own ideas about modesty and what it means for a woman to cover her head. Krista's husband, Ismail, is a Muslim from Libya, and Krista met her in-laws for the first time when Alia was a toddler, and they took her there.
My husband's family lives in a very modest home that is pretty bare except for cushions on the floor. And we arrived there after traveling for many hours. It was close to 30 hours of travel.
I remember getting off the plane and I felt like I was like the ball in a game of catch. I was being I was going around a circle of people being held and hugged and kissed, and it was
These
really...
are all the relatives you'd never met before, right?
Yeah.
And you were small enough that they could just pass you around like a large ball.
Yeah.
And right when we arrived, we were hustled in a very small car that contained way too many people to my mother-in-law's home, where we sat for hours, you know, visiting with family and friends and sitting on the floor and sipping strong tea. And I quickly discovered that the men and the women socialized separately. So I lost my translator, who was my husband. So I just spent hours among these women, sort of letting their words kind of, the sound of their voices kind of wash over me because I couldn't understand what they were saying.
There are a lot of people and it's kind of chaotic. And everyone's wearing hijabs and very different clothing from what we wear here, like very modest floor-length skirts, like long-sleeve shirts.
And socializing. A social visit in Libya can last longer than an entire workday in the United States.
So. Now, Alia was with you. She's your daughter and she's your husband's daughter. Mm-hmm. So part of you must have been thinking, how much of my daughter's life will this culture become mm-hmm. at some point?
It was so moving to me to meet this family and realize how much they loved my child.
Without ever having met her.
Without ever having met her. My mother-in-law is an elderly Libyan woman who has a tattoo running from her lower lip to her chin to indicate that she's married. And, you know, she's illiterate. And she had a picture of Alia that she kept by her bed, and I know she continues to. And, you know, she just, it was so moving to see my mother-in-law and my sisters-in-law and all of the cousins just embrace my daughter the way they did. And in many ways, they were so much more intimate and present with her than even my own Western family would be.
The contrast being, I guess, that your own Western family would have a bigger than modest home with mm-hmm. all the amenities that are a part of a comfortable Western lifestyle, big television, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a real value for personal space, I think, in my family and just in my culture in general. So, you know, one thing I remember is my first night in Libya, I was staying at my sister-in-law's home, and right next to our bed in this tiny room was a crib where it was sort of like a makeshift kid's bed where Alia was sleeping. And I awoke sort of startled in the middle of the night because Alia had been coughing, and I awoke to find somebody leaning over her bed.
Not your husband.
Not my husband. It was my sister-in-law who had come directly into our room and was standing inches away comforting my own child. And to my, you know, to my sense, that was just such a different sense of personal boundaries. And it just sort of, it was like that the entire time I was in Libya.
Alia was only 4 at the time, but as she was telling me earlier, she was paying close attention to the long skirts and long sleeves and the headscarves that the women and the girls in Libya were wearing.
Most all the women were dressed like that. And
would you think that your trip to Libya, your time there, had anything to do with your own decision to experiment with wearing a headscarf yourself?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, I saw them, and I thought they were pretty, and I kind of thought they were different from what I usually wear, and I like to be different.
Alia Sueya got her first headscarf last summer, green, with sparkles. Alia's mother, Krista Bremer, admits she still hasn't made peace with it.
I was raised with a lot of physical freedom. You know, I lived in California for a long time. I'm a surfer. I traveled on my own. And I think that it is just so provocative to me and unsettling to me to see women's bodies covered. And so it's unsettling in the sense that it feels oppressive to me, or it has felt so in the mm-hmm. past. And it's provocative to me because it represents such a different way of being in the world as a woman. And there is something about that that I really admire, and I also envy. And I think there is part of me that really recognizes how much time I have spent in my own life grappling with my self-image and, you know, worrying about how I looked, dealing with sort of unrealistic body standards. And one thing I experienced when I was in Libya is that my sisters-in-law didn't have those same preoccupations at all. And it seemed to me that a lot of that had to do with the privacy that their clothing afforded them.
Krista Bremer wrote a magazine article examining her own feelings about body image and how her daughter wearing a headscarf caused her to rethink all that. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Her daughter, Alia, is 9 years old, and she's the one who wanted to try wearing a headscarf. Both mother and daughter remember the first day Alia took it to school.
I think it took me like 5 minutes to decide. I had it in my hands, and I was just kind of standing there. Should I wear this or not? Should I wear this or not? And I decided to, and I was standing in my room.
I drive her to school every day, and usually when I drop her off, I'm late for work, and I drive away pretty quickly. And on this particular day, I watched her walk away from me, and she had a really heavy backpack over her shoulder, and she was sort of bent under the weight of it. And as I was watching her walk away, she kneeled down at the doorway to the school and started to rifle through her backpack. And then she pulled out the headscarf just before she walked through the door and she put it on. And that moment was so unsettling to me that really was the seed for the piece of writing that I did for Oprah magazine. Because in that moment, I felt fear for her. I also felt like I was in awe of her courage. And also, probably most of all, I felt how little control I have over her destiny and her future. So just watching her walk through those doors with that headscarf on was a moment when I had to surrender as a mom. But what also really struck me is that she put this item of clothing on without any baggage or preconceptions about what it meant. And from the reactions that other kids had, I think they reacted to her the same way. You know,
if it wasn't a big deal for her, it wasn't going to be a big deal for them.
Right. I think that's probably true.
Well, I got asked lots of questions. Some people just stared at me. Some people asked me why I was wearing a headscarf. Some people asked, "Are you Muslim?" Things like that.
So take me through the answers. And then, the kids that were asking you, "Why are you wearing that?" What was your answer to that?
My answer was basically something like, I'm interested in being a Muslim, and to be a Muslim means to wear a headscarf and be modest. And then one girl actually said, she told me she'd moved to North Carolina from Egypt, and she told me she liked it, and she was used to that because of the fact that she'd moved from Egypt to North Carolina.
So that was encouraging.
Yeah.
Anybody say anything unkind?
No.
Nobody teased you?
Mm-mm.
And at the end of that school day, Krista, was that your first question? What happened? How did that play out?
Well, you know, every day I ask Alia how her day was, and she keeps a lot close to her chest. You know, she was very matter of fact. She said it was fine. She didn't have anything particular to report. She didn't even want to talk about wearing the scarf. It just wasn't a big deal for her. Or if it was, it wasn't something that she wanted to share with me.
Did you keep it on all that school day?
Yeah. Actually, I think the first day I took it off, like midday. I figured if I was going to wear it, I should probably wear it the whole day. And so I wore it on winter days, on cold days, and that way it was just a way of keeping warm.
At this point, Alia Swaya isn't sure what religion she wants to practice. Wearing the headscarf is one way of helping her decide. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Alia says she likes to try things that are different.
For me, it was both different, as in different from what I usually do, and then also different, as in different from what everyone around me is wearing and doing.
But it's not like being the only girl to show up with a purple turtleneck on one day and being different that way, right? Because when you wear the headscarf...
No.
All your hair is covered.
Yeah.
And in a way, the shape of your face changes.
Yeah.
And so you look a little bit different. You don't look like the Alia that I'm looking at across the table now, right?
Yeah. And I think part of the difference between the purple turtleneck and wearing, being the only one to walk in with a headscarf, is a headscarf, a purple turtleneck is something you decide to wear just because you decide to wear it. A headscarf you decide to wear because you're Muslim or because you're interested in being Muslim and you want to try wearing it or something like that. But a purple turtleneck, you decide to wear it because that's the piece of clothing you want to wear that day. And in a way, it's actually basically the same as everyone else because other people are probably wearing turtlenecks and, you know, it's not exactly the same, but it's basically the same thing, different color. And I wore it randomly. Like, I'd wear it for 3 days in a row. I'd wear it for a day. And then a month later, I'd wear it for 2 days. I kind of wanted to see how it felt for one day or a few days in a row, just to see what it's like.
But do you think there'll come a time next year or 5 years from now or 10 years from now when you're going to make a decision? I'm going to spend the rest of my life with my head covered or I'm not?
I don't know. I don't really think I'm going to make a decision whether or not to wear it. And I might just decide on a pattern of wearing it and not wearing it, or wear it randomly as I do now. I really don't know.
Alia Swaya's mother is Krista Bremer. One of her biggest fears was always that Alia would be teased or excluded in some way. Well, that doesn't seem to be happening. Krista says the perspective of her Libyan husband, Ismail, has helped her.
My husband has lived in this country for many years, and the only thing he knows is being an outsider. Whereas I have always belonged in a certain way, and I'm so fearful of my daughter being an outsider. I think he's familiar with what that feels like, so maybe he's not as afraid of it.
Are you any more comfortable now seeing her come down the stairs from her bedroom with a headscarf on?
I am, and I actually think that she looks beautiful when she wears it. I think it was courageous for her to make a choice to try this. And as I've watched her experiment with this, I've really developed confidence in her and her ability to take risks, to assert herself, and to deal with being different. And so in some ways, I've come to understand her strengths by watching her experiment with this. So I'm not really worried about her. I think that whatever path she chooses, she is going to be fine.
Krista Bremer and her daughter, Alia Swaya, joined me in our studio here in Chapel Hill. And we have a link to the essay that Krista wrote in Oprah Magazine. That's on our website at thestory.org. And if you have your own story about fitting in, trying to fit in, or fighting against social codes, well, I'd like to hear from you. The fastest way to get to me is through our website, thestory.org, or you can call me at 1-888-966-9862. You can also leave me a note on Facebook or at Twitter at The Story with DG. Thank you. Coming up on the program, the next chapter of our story about Luis Najera. Luis was a reporter in Juarez, Mexico, a city devastated by the fighting between the drug cartels and the authorities. Now, reporters in that country are regularly intimidated and killed. Luis reported for as long as he could, but then he got a tip that he was not safe, and so he fled to Canada.
I feel very strange here. At least I'm alive. Another friends in Juarez, they're dead now.
Luis was hoping for political asylum from Canada, and we'll find out what happened to him since we first talked. That's in the next chapter, coming up. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. As you know, many of the stories on the program catch our guests at moments of decision or at a crossroad in their lives. We're trying to make sure that we stay in touch with these people and their stories. And we're doing it with a segment called The Next Chapter. Today we have a next chapter for Luis Najera. Luis was a reporter in Juarez, the city that is perhaps at the center of Mexico's current drug war. And when Luis got a tip that he was a target, he and his wife decided to pack up, take their three kids, and become refugees in Canada.
I think that we can never go back. The drug cartels, they never forget. They know how to wait, but they never forget. These people have access to all the information that they want.
After almost 2 years of waiting, Luis Najera finally had his chance to make his case to the refugee commissioner in Canada, and he just found out that he and his family have been accepted as refugees. Now, as Luis says, that's only a part of the story because he'll always be looking over his shoulder. Ever since the war between the drug cartels escalated a couple of years ago, Luis has been covering stories of executions and corruption. He knew a lot of people, and clearly someone somewhere decided that he knew too much. Luis says he knew other reporters who'd been killed, and his newspaper was used to getting threatening calls. The trouble was you never knew if it was the drug cartels or the authorities who were angry. Luis remembers one time when he noticed just how closely he was being watched by members of the drug cartel he was writing about.
I was in a crime scene, and there's two police officers there were shot. And I was taking my pictures and doing my job. And I will say it's a teenager. It's around 12. 10 or 12.
Yeah, just a young boy.
The age. Yeah, just a young boy. And he came to me very, very frightened. And he said, "They're back." And I said, "Who?" "These men, the men who shot the police officers, they're back." Huh. I said, how do you know that? "Because I see them." The most frightening moment to me was when he said, "They are pointing at us." "Pointing?" I said, yeah, they look at them. And I turn around and see these people, and he was taking picture of us. I said, "Wow." And I said, "The guy, you know what? Okay, go home. Lock the door and don't tell anything, not the police, not go home, please."
Luis Najera knew that he and his family could be in danger. Initially, he didn't think about quitting his job, but he did tell his wife to be more careful.
I said, "You know what? We have to be very careful about telephone, about who's knocking the door."
Yeah.
Later on, she told me that she noticed that she started being followed with minivans or SUVs.
Pretty soon, Luis and his wife started taking other precautions. They have three children, a teenager and two younger ones. Their teenage son understood the danger, but that still didn't make it easy.
He asked us, "Hey, can I go to a party?" "No." "Why?" "You know why." "Oh, come on. It's not fair." "Yeah, it's not fair, but it's safer." And the middle, my middle son, he all the time asking me, "Hey, Dad, can we go to a park to play?" And I said, "No." And I mean, I can. How can you explain to a 8-year-old boy, "We can't be there because it's an open space, and I have some concerns about our security." It's you can't explain that to a kid.
Luis Najera continued his reporting, but about a year ago, he found himself looking over his shoulder constantly. He was convinced that his phone was being tapped, and his work became more and more difficult because it was harder for him to know who to trust.
One day, I was covering an execution. A police officer, a friend, a good cop, he just passed and he just touched my shoulder and said, "Aguas." Aguas means waters.
Yeah.
It's a slang. It's a way to see, be careful.
And did you know right at that moment that this was a very, very serious warning? Or did you have to go and think about it?
No, I know. I know because this guy, he have very, very, very valuable information because he have access to the good guys and the bad guys. And this warning, I said, this is not a good moment. And I went back home. I spoke with my wife and said, you know, I think that this is very serious. We should leave. And
what did she say?
Why? You know what? We have to leave. Why? We have to leave. Don't ask more. Don't ask me anymore. I have to explain you later. Because if you tell all the things to your wife in this moment, you never know how she's going to react.
So you just said, I can't tell you now. We have to leave.
Yeah, we have to leave. And why? We have to leave.
Did you have bags packed already?
No. We fled Mexico only with 3 suitcases. We have to pack fast. And we buy the plane tickets for internet and very, very fast. And we said, let's go. Okay, let's go.
What was it like to leave?
Well, the saddest moment to me was when I closed the door of my house. Because when I heard the click from the lock, I said, well, I'm leaving my house, my memories, my job, my family. That moment was the hardest to me.
And must have been so hard on your kids, too.
Yeah, I think that still they can't comprehend what happened.
Luis Najera is a former reporter from a crime-ridden part of Ciudad Juarez. He's been waiting to find out the result of his asylum application in Canada. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Now, just 6 weeks after he arrived in Canada, Luis got word that one of his former colleagues, Armando Rodriguez, had been killed. Luis says that Armando's death began with a warning.
The police found a man hanged from the bridge, but this man doesn't have a head. This happened at around 7 a.m. Maybe 40 minutes later, police found the head in a bag under the statue of the, we call El Papelerito. Papelerito means the boy who sells
the newspapers. This is a monument for journalists in Juarez.
Yeah, right? It's a monument for journalists, yeah. And the head was at the feet of the monument, of the statue. I spoke with my former colleagues there, and they said, we think that this is a warning, a big warning for someone. And yeah, they're true. They're right. Next day, around 8 a.m., one of the most experienced journalists in the crime area, he was shot in front of his 2 daughters, when he was taking them to school.
Is this Armando Rodriguez?
Yeah, Armando Rodriguez, yeah.
Was he a friend of yours?
Yeah, we were colleagues in 1995, 1996 when I worked for El Diario, and the same newspaper that he worked when he was shot. And and we see each other daily because all the days we have to be covering executions.
Yeah. How did you hear the news, Luis?
I like to check in all the time, the digital newspapers.
Right.
And that day we are just checking and I start to search on the internet and all the pages have, they said, okay, Armando is dead and all these things. And it was shocking to me. And when my wife came and my wife know him, and I said, you know what, Armando, well, we call El Choco, is his nickname. And we said, you know what, Choco is dead. What? Yeah, yes. Oh. And we like paralyzed for a moment and we said, wow. And I remember that my wife watching me and said, you're right. We should leave. We have to leave. Yes.
You mean it was a good thing that we did leave, right?
Yeah. I think that in that moment, she understand a lot of things.
That it was important and, that you left.
Yeah, and she understand why we have to do the things we do.
Were you thinking, wow, that could have been me?
Yeah, I think a lot of things. I think what happened if I was in Juarez, what would happen if... Because next day of Armando's death, another journalist, he have an online paper, he went to the funeral home, and when we, I think we are on his way home, and way back home, he received a call, and they said, okay, you're next. And in that moment, he goes, he fled to U.S., to El Paso, Texas. And now he's living in El Paso. And we said, wow. And later, well, from the Armando, since Armando's dead, I think another two journalists had been shot in Juarez.
As happy as he is to be in the safety of Canada, Luis Najera says going back to Mexico isn't an option for him.
No, I can't go back. No, in my experience, the drug cartels, they never forget. They know how to wait, but they never forget.
And you couldn't even go to live on one of the coasts and be far, far away from the border?
There's a lot of information, like the elector's card or the social insurance
right,
number.
There's ways of tracking people down?
Yeah. And, okay, I can be on the coast working as a waiter, but at some point I have to put my name on some paper or some document and because I need to have the all the benefits, no?
Right.
And these people have access to all the information that they want.
So let me be clear about this. Does this mean that you and your wife, your kids, you can never go back to Mexico?
I think that we can never go back. It's sad to me because my parents are old. My friends are there. My mother and father-in-law are old too. I don't know what happened. I spoke yesterday with another people from Mexico, and I said that climbing for refugee, it's like being in an amusement park. You know, sometimes you are up, sometimes you're down. It's like a roller coaster of emotions. You are happy when you're here, but then you are sad. In my case, I can find a job because nobody wants to hire a journalist. Sometimes I can't do anything here. This is one of the hardest part.
And you have a refugee claim underway in Canada. What happens if the Canadians say no?
I hope that day I have enough money to try to find refuge in another place.
Well, we caught up with Luis Najera on Skype for our next chapter segment. We wanted to see how things turned out. His wife and three kids spent a year and 8 months in Canada awaiting their asylum hearing. Luis had spent weeks preparing his evidence file. It was over 700 pages long, documenting the effect the bloody drug war in Mexico has had on journalists there. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Finally, the morning came when they would make their case for refugee status.
We wake up around 5:30 a.m. We, you know, take a shower, dress and all the things. And before we leave, we bend on our knees at the living room and we take our hands and we make a prayer. So we ask God if he can give us confidence and patience and peace, wherever the result was. We said, okay, this is the day we are waiting for, so let's see how the things work.
Luis and his family arrived and filed into the hearing room. His children were introduced and properly identified, and then a friend led them out to wait at a park nearby. The tale Luis and his wife were about to tell wasn't for their children's ears. Not yet. The hearing resumed, and the tribunal officer kept it short. Not too many questions.
The tribunal officer said, okay, I think I'm done. I'll be back in 11:30, so in 1 hour and a half later, and I'm going to give you my decision, okay? Probably it's one of the longest 1.5 hours in my life. Yeah, and we wait, and we wait, and we wait.
And finally, the tribunal officer returned with her decision.
I take my wife's hand, stay close, and she said, this tribunal officer found enough evidence to declare the claimants protected persons or refugees. Wow. This moment is unbelievable. It's amazing. My wife starts crying. And I cry too. I'm not going to say, oh, I'm a big macho man. No, I cry. This is not just for me. No, I think that this is very good for a lot of people who still are in Mexico facing threats, risking their lives. And probably this is going to help them to leave that horror.
It was just over a week ago when Luis Najera and his family were granted a new start in Canada. For Luis, none of it seems real. Not yet.
Through all these days after the hearing, this is some like a bad dream that I'm having. Probably tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I will be still in Mexico, you know, see those horrible or gruesome things that I saw there. There's a lot of emotions and things. Sometimes I feel like one of these movie shows lost character because sometimes they are living in a parallel life and sometimes they are living here, and I don't know. It's, believe me, it's a strange feeling now. Very strange feeling.
Luis Najera joined us on Skype from his new home country in Canada. Now, if there's a guest on the story, someone you might have wondered about and wondered what happened or what's happening, let us know. We'll track that guest down and let you know. Reach me at our website, thestory.org, or using the phone at 1-888-966-9862. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Tomorrow on the program, I'll talk with Larry and Ellen Johnson, a couple who have lived their entire lives in the Gulf Coast area, and they run a family seafood business. But it's more than just their income that the Deepwater Horizon blowout has affected. It's really touched everything in their way of life. I asked them to think back to the early days of the oil blowout.
About 10 days went by before I really started hearing the oil is coming. In other words, they were not going to be able to stop this. And I'm thinking, we're in trouble.
I didn't really think at the time it would affect us. But when they said they couldn't stop it, I was like in shock.
When he heard it, I think we, for the most part, as a human nature people, we think things are going to be okay. This will be fixed. This will won't be as bad as it sounds today. So I noticed that he was like shocked and at awe with it. But yet each day I kept hearing him say, I can't believe this is not getting fixed. I can't believe they can't stop the oil. I can't believe this oil is coming in.
I'll talk with Larry and Ellen Johnson, as well as their lawyer, Al Jordan, who's representing the Johnsons and other fishing families on the Gulf Coast. That's tomorrow on the program. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.